From Katie McCabe's dad taking her to that first football match and making the impossible seem real, to encouraging words and constant belief. From getting scouted, to a debut, to a cap, to...
And Katie McCabe walks out as captain tonight.
A little support can change the game. Win the chance to meet Katie, plus daily football match tickets. Cadbury game-changing wins. Grab a pack to enter.
T's and C's apply. UK and ROI 18+. Visit gamechanging.cadbury.co.uk to enter and for full T's and C's and prize details. MPN for ROI.
BetterHelp Online Therapy bought this 30-second ad to remind you, right now, wherever you are, to unclench your jaw. Relax your shoulders. Take a deep breath in and out. Feels better, right? That's 15 seconds of self-care. Imagine what you could do with more. Visit betterhelp.com/randompod for 10% off your first month of therapy. No pressure, just help. But for now, just relax.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Dropping the Gloves. Our guest is Marty McSorley. I was lucky enough to meet Marty, gosh, probably 10 years ago now, Marty, at a charity event in Halifax. And typically when you meet your idols, you know, Ray Bourque was my guy. Eric Lindros was my guy. And Marty McSorley, I grew up watching him. It goes well. And there's very rare that they exceed expectations. And you think of Marty McSorley, and people kind of get this for me too. It's like, oh, you're a dumb, big, dumb goon. Doesn't know how to, you know, handle himself. He's probably going to chug 100 beers and just be an animal. The most eloquent, the most just thoughtful person in hockey I've ever met. I'm not saying this lightly because I've met a lot of people, Marty. I've been on a lot of teams, and I'm not trying to blow smoke. That's not due, but I love talking to you. I feel like it's just always a treat for me. So first, I want to say thank you for joining the show. And second of all, this is kind of a question away from hockey. How did you get the way you are? Like, I don't know anything about your history, your upbringing, but boy, you just have a good head on your shoulders, man.
Well, you know, sorry, John, I'll shut
no
that
worries.
Off. The biggest thing for me was growing up on a farm with 9 brothers and sisters, you know, and 10 kids. And the expectation was you pull your weight. Mm-hmm. And you do your job, and there was nobody really to complain to. And with 3 older brothers, and one of them who was borderline lunatic, as you probably know, John, you know, there was really not much I was going to see in the NHL that I wasn't around at home. Whether we were skating on the canal down at the farm or up in an old chicken barn that we had cleaned out, made into a big long ball hockey kind of a stadium in our minds, right? As kids. Working out up in the barn and putting our weights and everything in there, and just the expectations with all my brothers and sisters. And when I went off to junior, I was like, oh my God, this is so much easier. For me, I was a fan of the game. I grew up a big fan of the game, and I had some catching up to do because coming from the farm at 11 or 12 years old, I went into Hamilton and my dad put me on the ice with the AAA team, and they were fired up to have me. They wanted me to stay there. They were going to help us with, you know, pay for whatever. And we couldn't do it. There was no way. We were 25, 30 miles south of Hamilton. 4 years later, the guys that were my age, the Dave Anarchuk's, Joe Cirillas, I couldn't carry their skates. I was so far behind.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Because, you know, I might be one of the last guys that actually played their whole minor hockey in a town of like 1,000 people, right? So, and then having to try to fight your way back up and catch up, right?
Yeah.
And so you have to think the game and figure it out. And also too, though, then as I got into the NHL, being a fan of the game and watching guys and always wanting to be a better player, mm-hmm. striving to be a better player. I didn't work on being a better fighter, but I tried to work every day on being a better player. And my expectation was to be a guy that wasn't scared of doing the tough guy role, but how do I do it and be on the ice all the time? And I was really fortunate from a standpoint that you go into Pittsburgh, a really bad team, you fight, you fight to make the team. And then I go to Edmonton where they needed the protection, but they didn't necessarily need the fights.
Yeah.
But you had to try to keep up with them. And they, you know, I kind of challenged them a little bit to say, listen, I will continue to do the job. I want to be a good player. And them allowing me to grow in a wonderful, wonderful environment, but figure it out too that, you know, how do I protect these guys, but not make it into a back alley game? You know, so it was really awesome. And you know, there were certain things that happened, you know, that as my maturation, as you kind of forge your own way, you know, to be Dave Semenko, like you mentioned, when I got to Edmonton, the biggest thing about Semenko is I could pick his brain. I say, Semenko, like, what should I have done in that instance? He says, well, sometimes we just need the battleship in the harbor. And then another time he goes, well, every now and then we must remind them. And it was just Dave's way. And he was wonderful to me. But you know, Mark Messier, too, on the bench in Edmonton. There would be times I'd look down the bench and Mess wouldn't do anything. Or he would do this, shake his head no, meaning that it's not needed. Other times I'd look down the bench and I'd get nothing. At that point, I'd look back at Slats as if, put me out there, you know. And I had a couple of really, John, really interesting, and if you want to elaborate, in Edmonton,
yes.
You know, the old question we ask people sometimes is, when did you arrive? Mm-hmm. And sometimes people are in the league 3 or 4 years and they still haven't truly arrived. You know, the old saying, one foot in the door and one foot on a banana peel, mm-hmm. right? And so we were in Edmonton and we were playing. I thought I was playing pretty well. And Hartford came into town, had no tough guys. They were not a very good hockey team. And we always dressed 2 or 3 extra guys for warmups. And then the trainer would come out of his training room and give guys the hook that they're not going to go out for the start of the game. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was playing and Mike Kruszlinski was sitting next to me and you're ready to play. This is great. This is going to be an opportunity, you know, maybe to get a couple of points. Right. And Mike Kruszlinski goes, hey, and he points up to the trainer and Barry Stafford kind of gives me the hook. And I said, no. And I said, no. Meaning that's bull crap. I mean, I've been playing, I've been protecting the guys against all the tough teams, all that, and I've been getting better and better and getting some points and doing whatever is necessary physically, but it was their way of getting other guys in the lineup. So I stood up, paused for a second, and I started walking to the coach's room. And this is after warm-ups. And you're dealing now with guys, Glenn Sather, John Muckler, Teddy Green, who have had a ton of success, right? And run the Edmonton Oilers. Who, you know, I knew where I fit in there, really. And I heard Mark Messier goes, hey, where are you going? And I looked back and I said, in there. And he goes, are you sure? And it was just enough.
Yeah.
It was just enough to make me pause. So I knocked on the door and they said, come in. So I come in and I'm skates on, jersey the whole nine yards. And John Muckler says, what do you want? I said, I want to know why I'm not playing. And John Muckler says, because we said you're not playing. Glenn Sather put his arm on John Muckler's arm. And he goes, why? Do you think you should be playing? I said, yes. I'm a leader on this hockey team. I protect those guys. Those are my guys. I can't do it as a part-time player. And I said, they need to know that I'm there every game, that I've got their back no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn Sather kind of looks and pauses. He goes, you're right. It won't happen again.
Wow.
He then held his finger up and goes, as long as you uphold your end of the bargain. Meaning, those are my guys. If you take responsibility, you have to take responsibility.
Wow.
And I was like, good, great. I went back out. And he goes, I can't play it tonight, but it won't happen again as long as you uphold. From that point forward, I knew that as long as I look after the guys, that nothing happens to my guys. And so it was about 2 weeks later, we're playing Detroit. Gerard Gallant was always really, who was a really good player. I really liked Gerard Gallant as a player. I like him as a person, too. He was playing for Detroit. They were really hard on Curry and Gretzky. And Gerard Gallant is out there against Curry, giving him the business a little bit. And I stood up on the bench and I yelled, Yari, get off. and nobody told me to go. And Yari comes over to the bench, and I jump on the bench. I skated up to Gerard Gallant, put my stick into his ribs. And he goes, what are you doing here? I said, I've come to kill you. And he goes, oh, no, you're not. I said, oh, yes, I will. And I can get to you anytime I want. And he went to the right to their bench. Somebody else jumped on. I just circled back, went to our bench and yelled at Yari. Yari jumped on. I might have been on the ice for 12, 13 seconds. Just to let Detroit know, but let my guys know too,
yeah,
right? That I would be there. And just a couple instances like that, Slats more than allowed me to do, to have my leadership with his, it, you know, playing in the finals against Boston. I hit Michael Telvin hard in center ice. And we, more of a collision, and I think, and Michael Telvin was an important part of their team in the Stanley Cup finals. And Glenn came to me and said, what happened? I said, it was dead clean. And he goes, you're sure? And I said, absolutely. And so he went off that premise. And after the game, he goes, no, no, this was a clean hit. And, you know, I challenge anybody, and, you know, because he trusted me.
Yeah.
Right. So it was, it was a great relationship. And wow, also too, John, in that environment, the Davey Hunters, the Andy Moogs, the Randy Greggs, the Charlie Huddies, they cheered for me to continue to get better. And nobody was worried about their ice time because everybody was having success. And it was a wonderful environment. And, you know, Mess and Gretz, and to talk to Koff about skating. And what I can't stress enough about the environment I was put into, which allowed me to blossom and grow and develop as a player. And then from there, I tried to take that with me to LA and figure out times that you can do the job. And how do I do it? You know, we were in LA, and this is a maturation of that whole, we were trying to get in the playoffs. I was maxed out. I had 3 game misconducts, which later on they started to give those things out really quickly to try to put us up against the brink, right? So we're playing, there's about 8 games left in the season, and we're playing Detroit, who's loaded with talent. Coffey, Steve Yzerman, all the guys. Fedorov, Lidstrom, really a great team. But we're up 4-0, you know, into the second period. We're playing as good as we've played all year, and we're trying to get in the playoffs. It's around 96. And Sean Berg goes out and spears Gretzky. And now I'm maxed out in game misconducts. If I go out and go after Sean Berg, I'm going to get a game misconduct and have to sit out 2 games when we're in a, chasing down a playoff spot. So I waited for a commercial, and I went over to the Detroit bench. And the linesman's there. I said, no, I'm just going to say hi to Koff and Stevie. And Paul Coffey and Steve Yzerman are standing there by the door. I said, how you doing, guys? And they're like, good. What are you doing here? I said, we got a problem. Koff goes, we don't have a problem. I goes, yeah, we have a problem. And Koff goes, what do you mean? I said, Sean Burr speared Gretz. Koff goes, not my problem. And I said, it is now. I said, I'm maxed out in game misconducts. I don't want to see Sean Burr one more time tonight. I said, if I see him one more time, I'm either going to break your arm or I'm going to break your arm. And I said, I don't want to do it, guys, because I'm big fans of both of you. And Stevie Yzerman walks behind the bench, talks to Scotty Bowman. Sean Burr never played another shift the rest of the game. And right? But it was to avoid a confrontation. But how do I make this happen and still look after my guys, right?
That's so unbelievable. So hold on, Marty. That was a lot to take in. I want to go back to when you go into the coach's room. You're 22 years old, probably.
I got traded at 22. I was 23.
23. How can you do that? Honestly, because I would never in a million years. I had that situation that you went through hundreds of times where they go, right, you're out. I feel like I should play. I would never have the guts to do that. What goes through your head to do that?
Well, I knew that Glenn wanted me to be successful because I think Glenn cheered for guys like me. I think that, you know, guys like Craig McTavish, that Edmonton signed him and brought him in to give him an opportunity. There was a lot of guys that Glenn Sater gave opportunities to.
Yeah.
And Teddy Green was wonderful. Teddy Green and practices and different things. I guess I trusted the character of those people,
mm-hmm,
right? I didn't go in there throwing stuff or whatever. And I was just like, hey, listen, I'm doing everything I can here to be what you want.
Yeah.
Right. and in a sense that I just want to know why. But also too, John, I think guys like yourself and myself, that even though in junior we may have scored a ton of points or done different things, we always had our naysayers. And we always had to climb over those guys. Yeah. We always had to, and there was, I'd go into training camp when I was in Pittsburgh, I had number 78. And not until after a couple of exhibition games did I have number 4 hanging in my stall, right? It's almost like we were always up against a challenge. And so it was easy enough for me. And I guess you're not wrong from a standpoint. I don't think I would have done that in Pittsburgh. I never felt that they really understood the nature of the game and what we were trying to do. And see, in Edmonton too, they respected everybody's job. Like, you know how some coaches would put a tough guy out on the ice for 30 seconds in a game? Glenn respected the guy's job. Like, if I went out and had a big fight in a key time of the game when somebody did something, the guys would be cheering for me and I'd get the back half of the next power play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right? I mean, how great is that from a team standpoint, right?
Well, and just the fact that, A, you had that skill, because you mentioned you didn't work on fighting. And that's rare, because you want to be the best fighter, but to have the wherewithal to be like, no, I'm going to play. That's why you had a 16-year career, 17-year career. It's because you did work on that skill. So you knew the fighting was always going to be there. So it's funny how it dovetails together. It's like, man, I'm going to work on my skills, and I get to play with the best team in the world. And then I get to go on the power play because I do have those skills. It's just, I love that stuff.
In Edmonton, me going on the power play at that time, it was simply a reward, right?
Yeah.
It was a reward to say, love how you stand up for our guys and our team. And, and you got all the guys on the bench cheering for you, right? Should I be on there? We used to have a saying at the start of the year, if you're on Gretzky or Messier's line and you probably don't belong there, probably going to get traded. But the other side of it is we, in 1987, which I believe was the best team in NHL history, and Gretz and Mess say the same thing, though I know the league came out with 1985, but 1987, we picked up Rayo Ruotsalainen, who was a wonderful player, a Finnish defenseman who could fly and shoot the puck, and Rayo was really a good guy. But then we also picked up Kent Nielsen, and we had a second line of Nielsen, Glenn Anderson, and Mess. And I was just like, we intimidated teams with our morning skates. It was such a magical time. It really was, John.
Talk about that, because I played on some good teams, the Blackhawks with Taze Kane, Hossa, Sharp, things like
that. Yeah.
It's very, you're aware that you're the best team on the ice, and you know you should win. What was the vibe like? Because you're coming in, you've won 2 cups now. Could you just feel it in the room, like we should dominate every single team, or were there teams that you would buckle down for?
Well, we had the nemesis Calgary that was right south of us.
Yep.
And Calgary was really good. But, Dale Hawerchuk in Winnipeg, I got to give Dale Hawerchuk his due. If they'd have been in the Eastern Conference, I do believe that they'd have gone to a Stanley Cup Finals. Because Dale Hawerchuk was a marvelous player. The one year in 1988, Calgary finished first overall in the NHL. We finished third, and Winnipeg finished fifth. And that's with us playing each other as often as we did.
Right, yeah.
That's how good our – so we had the nemesis of Calgary. But I always felt in Edmonton there was this challenge. There was this challenge for us to win. We would be in a game where we might be down a goal going to third period, and Mess would look across the room at Glenn Anderson and go, hey, Andy, it's time. Let's go. Like, it's time. Because these guys were all competitive. But, you know, the strength of that team also, though – like a Randy Gregg was a wonderful player. Charlie Huddy should be in the Hall of Fame. Charlie Huddy was third offensive option in 1987, scored 22 goals, was plus 82. In the Canada Cup, he'd play 4-on-4 against the Russians and handle it very easily. Charlie Huddy was a wonderful, Steve Smith, as you saw him in Chicago, really developed into a very talented player. We had some really great people around, the Mark Napiers. They really helped that team win and helped keep the character up. There was, there wasn't those character flaws throughout the lineup.
So let's contrast that to the team now, because obviously Edmonton's always chasing, you know, your glory years, the four straight cups, all the Hall of Famers. And now we got the big guys, obviously Draisaitl and McDavid, and there's some good pieces around them, Bouchard and Nurse, and not the depth, I don't think, that you guys had, but McDavid is McDavid. He's the best player on the planet. What do you make of this team? Because I know you follow them closely. They've been to the finals 2 years in a row. Like, what are your thoughts on that? I'm very interested. What do they need to do, Marty?
Okay. I want to, you know, and again, I generally say what I think.
Yeah, be careful though.
Yeah, no, but no, because I really think that the coach has come in and done a really good job there. I think he's endeared himself to the guys. They go out and they compete for him. They've had a lot of success. But I think that they need to give a few more players responsibility in that lineup. Like, I think that Draisaitl and McDavid in the playoffs, it would be 5 or 6 minutes in, and then it was just like, it was Draisaitl and McDavid all the time. And yeah. I think everybody else kind of felt almost like filler. I don't think that they felt the responsibility of being a difference in making that team win. If Leon Draisaitl was with 25 other NHL teams, he'd be their best player and he would be their number one centerman. Mm-hmm. Mark Messier scored 50 goals once with Gretzky in Edmonton. And he was playing Gretz's left wing long before they ever won a cup. When Mark Messier went and took the responsibility of putting together a really good line, with him and Andy being the core, that, you know, that would help dominate games. I mean, I can't tell you how many big goals they scored. Mark Messier never scored 50 goals, and actually Mark Messier left goals – he left goals unscored simply by his devotion to – going out and taking hard faceoffs, being really hard on the other team's number one centerman, on being dominating physically in the middle of the ice. Mm-hmm. And so Mess took that responsibility. I really think you've got to give Connor his own line and Leon his own line and say, we need to have two lines. What Florida, the first game against Florida, the pace of that game was incredibly high. Edmonton totally outskated him. I think Marchand even struggled with the pace. The second game, Florida, very intelligently, made it a mucky, ugly, awful, chippy
playing in the mud.
Scrums after everything. It frustrated Draisaitl and McDavid. It just, now you had everybody in Edmonton from Kane to Nurse, all these guys yapping back and face and getting, and it, they totally lost their identity. And they took the crowd in Edmonton out of the game, and Florida goes down to Edmonton, to Florida for game three. What did they do? The same exact thing. They made it into a mucky, ugly, slow the game down, no pace to the game, and they clobbered them because they're really talented. They knew who they are. They've got really great, unselfish stars, Ekblad, Barkov, you know, Bennett. Those guys, they're very unselfish. And like if you think of Florida too, they let one of their stars go, who they probably wanted to keep, was Montour, who was probably a little bit more risque, and they kept their identity. And they played wonderfully. Edmonton needed to keep the pace of that up. But by doing that, they need to have two lines, give them the responsibility, know they're going to go out there. Like you had one instance where Draisaitl was out for almost a minute and a half. Florida got a penalty. They kept him on the ice and did whatever they could to stall to start the power play, and they got 2 minutes of mediocre power play.
Because he was gassed.
Start the other guys for 45 seconds and then go back to McDavid and Draisaitl. Yeah. You know, give those somebody else a responsibility for, you know. But also, too, there's, I mean, if I'm on that team, I'm going to look at, you know, other than Bouchard, every one of those defensemen, and Ekholm is a great defenseman. We just need to be even. We don't need to be plus. We don't need to cheat. We don't need, we've got McDavid and Draisaitl. We can't be cheating and taking penalties and be on the wrong side of people. And let's be really defensively accountable. And I go back to 1988. We traded Paul Coffey and didn't sign Rail Ruotsalainen. I got moved back to defense for the whole playoffs. We had six really big, Randy Gregg, Steve Smith, Kevin Lowe, myself, Charlie Huddy, Craig Muni. None of us were going to break any scoring. Boston got 14 shots in the first game, 12 in the second. Right. And we knew what we needed to do to help win. And I think Edmonton, with that mindset, and give some of those guys responsibility, keep the pace of the game up. Don't get caught in the scrums. know who you are, right? Know who you are. And that's like, I complimented Florida big time because they did. And they did it to perfection. I think they could have taken a lot of the Marchand out of the game by keeping the pace of the game up and allowing their guys to skate.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly. I think that's ideal to have that. But well, gosh, when you're the coach and you have those two horses staring at you and you start to maybe slip a little bit, and you go, it's easy to say 97-29 and go out there again.
Yeah, you know what? I think you have to go to them and say quality, not quantity.
Yeah.
Quality, not quantity, right? And you know, so if somebody else starts the power play for 45 seconds, and then you get them out there. Right?
What were the minutes like for Wehner when he played? Was he getting, because McDavid was playing a half an hour a game. Like he was playing a lot of ice. What would Wayne and those guys get?
It was funny. Wayne always wanted to be out killing penalties.
Oh, wow.
And they wouldn't use him on the 2-minute penalties. And I think that kind of, you know, bothered him. But Wayne's like, I got to stay in the game. Big moments, Wayne would look and expect to go.
Yeah.
And Slats knew that his big guys needed to eat, but at the same time, he was blessed with having, if you're coaching and you got two lines on the road, if that other team's first line can't be good enough defensively against what your top two lines, they're at a huge disadvantage. But if you only have one line, Florida could short shift two lines to check that first line to death, not allow them any space, and that's when Marchand's line kept coming out and then doing their damage.
Gosh, that's very true. Yeah.
Right? But if you have two lines, you can kind of control the bench a little bit more. You can control who's on the ice, and you could challenge the other team's top line to have to play defense against good players. And that's and I mean, there was goals scored in the playoffs where Draisaitl was on the ice with two other guys. I do think that has to be more of a focus there.
Yeah, I think people have been just begging for that for years, just to get some depth, get some just four lines so you can roll them. And that you're right, that's been the issue. You get to the playoffs, and I think they pushed a panic button.
John, this is something that I think that's not talked about enough. It's really hard for Canadian teams because they overpaid guys originally to keep them. And if you look at the teams that are having a ton of success, Vegas, no state tax.
Yeah.
Florida, both teams in Florida, Dallas. I mean, you do the record of the teams from no state tax. And I know people, when agents come in to talk to teams, like in California, they'll say, how do I make up the 13.5% state tax on these contracts?
Yeah.
That's a lot when you're dealing with a salary cap and trying to balance your roster, where, like, think of when Stamkos was negotiating with Toronto and then with Tampa. He could take a lot less in Tampa and stay there. And it's probably worth two very good players for them over the course of the playoffs.
Yeah. And Gary tries to play it down like, well, non-state tech teams have won. But I think the last 5 to 10 years has shown it's such an advantage being in the South and having a no-state tax, because you're basically giving them more money if they want to sign for a big ticket. But yeah, look at a Mitch Marner. Like he's heading south. All the big tickets are going south. It just makes sense for a player. Why not? Guys, you've probably heard of Viagra or Cialis, and maybe you've even tried them. If you're looking for something beyond the usual pill, meet Rougi et Ready. Other companies rely on similar ingredients to support blood flow, but Rougi et Ready is next-gen prescription treatment designed to help amplify the brain and increase blood flow. If the usual pills aren't doing the trick, Rougi et Ready could be the answer. It's a 3-in-1 formula. It dissolves under your tongue to absorb fast, so you'll be ready in just 15 minutes on average, and it can lasts up to 36 hours. That means you can stay confident, present, and in control when the moment's right. Want proof? Over 150,000 men have made the switch, and you can read their reviews right on the site. Getting started is simple. Rougi et connects you with a board-certified doctor 100% online, and if prescribed, your treatment ships quickly to your door. Connect with a provider at rougiet.com/gloves to see if Rougi et Ready prescription is right for you. You can use code GLOVES to get 15% off today. That's rougiet.com/gloves and use promo code GLOVES to get 15% off today. Head to rougiet.com/gloves and use code GLOVES to get 15% off today. Individual results may vary with prescription treatment. Compounded drugs are permitted to be prescribed under federal law, but are not FDA approved and do not undergo FDA safety, effectiveness, or manufacturing review. Please visit the Rougi et website for full safety information.
Yeah, I mean, especially if the guys want to win.
Yeah.
Right? A great player, you know, if you have an opportunity to go someplace, I think you're looking at, you're saying, okay, I want to go in an environment where I have a chance to win.
Yeah.
I think that's most of those guys, that's how they're wired, right? Which in a great way, they want to go where they can win.
So where does McDavid go? He's going to be UFA after this year. Stan Bowman has said they've had talks, but until there's ink on paper, you know better than anybody, the greatest player in the world can be traded. It's happened to you. You were a part of that trade. Do you see a world where McDavid gets traded?
Well, it really, it's up to both him and his wife, because these decisions, yep, John, are made with their wives.
Like, yep,
27-year-olds will say, okay, do you want to stay in Winnipeg or do you want to stay in Edmonton or do you want to go to Vegas or Dallas, right? I mean, don't think that the wife isn't being asked and you know, that's coming into consideration, because it is, mm-hmm, and it has to be, right? I mean, it's long-term. They've got skin in the game, right? Do I think that Connor wants to stay in Edmonton? Yes. Do I think that Daryl Cates, the owner up there, has, I mean, from Jeff Jackson, who was associated with Connor, is now the president of the team, the coach. I mean, going out and signing Leon to make sure that Leon is going to be there with Connor. Yeah. I think that they've done a lot of things. I think Bouchard has really come along, and he's been a wonderful player for them, and they've paid him and kept him. So they're willing to pay right to the cap. So they've done a lot of things to make Connor happy. I'm going to throw out a different scenario to you. If Connor McDavid says, okay, I'm going to go to Toronto and take less money, he's going to be on Hockey Night in Canada every weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, what would he make off the ice? 40, 45, 50?
Oh, he would, yeah.
Right? At the same time, if he took less to go there, not saying, I'm just throwing out a different scenario.
Yeah.
That, you know, because this is a discussion I've had with a number of guys, right? That, you know, obviously Edmonton, would I like to see him stay in Edmonton? Absolutely. 100%. You know, I've seen success there. I've experienced it myself. It was wonderful. You know, another thing to think about, would it be, I think Shohei Ohtani had two places he could go.
Mm-hmm.
Only two places, New York and Los Angeles, because of the worldwide brand. Right. And like the branding of Shohei Ohtani around the world. Would Connor McDavid be better for the game in New York City?
From Jill Scott's football coach giving up his weeknights to train her, to giving her tactics that will last a career. From making a young girl believe she can, to a debut. From playing for her country to winning the big one on home soil to
Jill Scott was today made an MBE.
A little support can change the game. Win the chance to meet Jill, plus daily football match tickets, Cadbury game-changing wins. Grab a pack to enter.
T's and C's apply. UK and ROI 18+. Visit gamechanging.cadbury.co.uk to enter in for full T's and C's and prize details. MPN for ROI.
BetterHelp Online Therapy bought this 30-second ad to remind you right now, wherever you are, to unclench your jaw, relax your shoulders, take a deep breath in and out. Feels better, right? That's 15 seconds of self-care. Imagine what you could do with more. Visit betterhelp.com/randompod for 10% off your first month of therapy. No pressure, just help. But for now, just relax.
It's a question just strictly from a business standpoint. Would the game be better off with him in New York?
Well,
because he is the best player in the game.
You don't need to sell the game in Edmonton. It's already been sold. Like they're always...
But I mean, you want to keep the game strong and alive and healthy, right? You really do. It's really important for the game to be healthy in places like Edmonton and Winnipeg. And mind you, Winnipeg's done a wonderful job. That general manager there, I mean, Kevin Sheveldale, has done a, because he's drafted really, really well. He's kept his guys happy. He's re-signed them. I've been super impressed with Winnipeg over the years. But it's important for those franchises to be healthy. You know, when Gretz went to New York, it was the best place for him to end his career. Mm-hmm. It really was. You know, I think that he had a chance to play, like when Pelé went to New York at the end of his career, right? You know, it's New York City. It's you know, how much of the world's focus is on New York City and how much of the world's media goes out of New York City, right?
Yeah, no.
So that's just a, that's a thought, right?
That is a thought. And I wonder, and talk about just, I know he's not going to be influenced or anything, but even you speaking about growing the game, obviously when you and Wayne go down to LA, the Southern market was non-existent. It was not a thing. It was LA and that's it. Do you think there was, I'm not a tin hat guy, but a push to get Wayne down south to grow the game? Because now you see the seeds that you guys planted. Like the game is so strong down there now.
What people don't know is Bruce McNoll had arranged to get a lunch with Wayne. I think if I remember correctly, he bought an auction item for lunch with Wayne.
Oh, I've heard that, yeah.
And then said, you know, and said, listen, they're actually trying to trade you because Bruce had bought half of the LA Kings. Wayne didn't believe him. So Bruce went and got on the phone with Peter Pocklington, and Wayne was in the room, and some of the things that Peter said shocked Wayne. And at that point, that's when Wayne said, okay, let's do this. I don't think there was anybody else in the game that was pushing it. Nobody really gave LA much merit. Bruce McNoll was such a wonderful salesman. John, I absolutely believe because of Bruce McNoll, like he took us and wore us out in training camp. We would finish training camp and go to North Carolina, which never had a team, Miami, which never had a team, St. Petersburg, we go to the Dome. Somebody's skate would cut the Freon. There'd be green Freon spraying up onto the ice. They'd put a pylon over. We'd finish the exhibition game. We played an exhibition game in Miami where there was patches of cement, and they had pylons and said it's a no-hitting game, right? I mean, we were in Dallas where it was a million degrees in the old Reunion Arena because they didn't have hockey there. But Wayne Gretzky with Bruce McNoll, Wayne Gretzky was the perfect guy because he was a consummate professional. And after games, he'd be going out with the CEO of Sony or this big businessman in this city that Bruce would invite in. Michael Eisner traveled with us in 1993 all through the playoffs, and his two boys would be there sometimes, which was great to have them. But the next year, then Disney steps in as one of the – Bruce McNoll was a tremendous salesman, and he, what I say, de-regionalized the game. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, okay, this can really work. George Gunn then coming into San Jose and building a great franchise up there, yeah. You know. But I think it was Wayne being the perfect guy to do it. So you're right from a standpoint, it was great for the game at Wayne at that stage. But how do we now grow the game even bigger internationally?
You're selling right? yourself short. I remember meeting you for the first time, and I, at these charity events, I'm a sort of an introvert, but then, you know, I loosen up a little bit. You weren't having it. You're like, you're coming to dinner with us. Let's go get in the car. We're going out. And you took me out with all your friends, and we had this great dinner, and you were engaging me. And I was like, holy cow, like, this is unbelievable. So you're selling yourself short, Marty, to the point where you were probably right there with him. Like, that was one of the best nights of my life. I still remember it. It was awesome.
John, when I went to Pittsburgh as a 20-year-old, there wasn't great veterans, and there were some young kids came in that didn't succeed, that I thought could have and should have. And then I go to Edmonton, and I'm given every opportunity. Like Paul Coffey said, if you need a car here, I'll get you a car for a couple of weeks until you get ready. Mess says, you're not staying at the hotel. You're going to come and stay at my house. And one of the reasons I got traded to Edmonton, because Mess and I had two big fights. You know, and I went out and stood at the door of the penalty box and waited for him to come out for the second one, right? And he was like the first guy to give me a big hug and welcome me to the team. And Gretz was like, Marty, great to have you. Welcome to the Edmonton Oilers. And I was shocked, John.
And keep in mind, everybody listening, it's not like those guys are 30-year-old veterans. Gretzky was probably 24, Coffey 24. They were young kids. What do you see? And this is – it's a question to compare then and now. What's changed? Because I don't want to dump on today's kids, but if there's a noticeable difference with respect and how you approach the game and just how you take care of your business, I'm not seeing that same translating in today's game.
I think we have to be careful all the way through the league management, the teams, that you don't overhype guys strictly because you can sell them as stars. Like there are guys that go to the All-Star game every year that everybody hypes as their star.
Careful.
But if I'm a general manager of a team, I don't want that guy on my team, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you got guys that you know, I laugh at sometimes and I see them on the all-star ballots and everything else. And I'm like, nobody would trade for them. Or you start to see teams get better when they leave.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this so could maybe be the Toronto Maple Leafs potentially.
Anyways, yeah. Well, yeah.
Another topic.
Yeah. There are guys that go out and score points and we sell them as stars. I think we know that the players that help you get in the playoffs might be a lot different than the guys that win you the playoffs. Like, look at Patrick Maroon. Patrick Maroon figured it out.
Yeah.
I mean, his value. Corey Perry could have been my favorite player of the whole playoffs because he plays with this grr, but he's smart enough to be in those positions to score, take a cross check on the ribs. Because he gets pounded on as much as he gives out the garbage, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they figured it out. They know how they're going to have value come playoffs. And I love watching those guys. So let's make sure that the guys like Barkov, the guys like McKinnon, who's wonderful, Sidney Crosby. I mean, we got a lot of Ovechkin this year. But to me, Sidney Crosby could be my favorite player in the league because he just – for Sidney Crosby, it's the emblem on the front, not the name on the back, right? And I love that about him. And I'd like to see him get traded with a chance to win again.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's such a great player, would be so wonderful to any team that he went to. Like I said, McKinnon, Kopitar, who I had the pleasure of watching down here.
Yeah, Kopi.
You know, they've got Kempe and some young guys here. But if you videotaped Kopitar, you could teach any young centerman how to properly play the game. It's really wonderful. And he could have gotten more points, a lot more points, by cheating, playing for a bounce, or stretching his zone and not being reliable in his own zone. That's not how Kopi plays. And
yeah, I think that's a dying trait in today's games. You look at these kids and you see it with all the good young superstars where it's just offense, 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 me, points, cookies. And they lose what it takes to win a game. That's why you mentioned like the Sam Bennett's of the world. Those guys are the ones that are so valuable. And when those guys do come around, you're like, oh, wow, that's amazing. But when you were playing, a dime a dozen. Like that's how you played the game.
Yeah. See, Yari Curry, when Wayne got hurt in 1993, the year went to the finals here in LA, Wayne missed the first 25, 30 games. Yari Curry was our number one centerman. We were 1 point behind Pittsburgh for first overall in the NHL.
Crazy.
We were 19-7-2, and Yari was our centerman because he just understands and plays the game so honestly, you know. And it doesn't give you as much. It's not as much flash and dash as all the breakaways and everything else. That cheating, I'm hoping there might be even some rules that they could implement if they want a little bit more offense, but don't have the guys change their priorities.
Yeah.
I don't think that's, you know, John, and this is something I think that you can really attest to. I don't think enough guys say to these young defensemen in junior or college, if I can walk down the bench and put you on the ice in my own zone, consistently, you will play 15 years in the NHL.
Right? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't need to score 50, 60, 70 points. If I can trust you defensively and you can eat up 22, 23 minutes, you are a valuable player.
Gustav Forsling.
They don't coach that.
Yeah. And it's such a valuable piece of the game where everybody wants to be sexy now and flashy and be the next Cale Makar. You're absolutely right. You could throw out six stay-at-home defensemen and be just as effective as six all-star caliber points guys because you got to defend.
Yeah. Well, is Florida better with Carlson or Ekblad?
Right? Yeah. Oh, 100% Ekblad. And he's the one who gets it where he could put up more points, but he's like, no, I don't need to. I could talk to you all day. I know you probably got a million things to do. I'm a fighter. I've fought through my career, and so do you. I want to pick your brains. Who was the toughest guy you ever fought? Like, which guy did you go into their rank? Was it a Wendell Clark, who's an underrated tough guy? Was it a Proby? Was it the Grim Reaper? Who was the guy you're like, oh boy, here we go?
Now you learn pretty quickly as you get, like when I was 20 years of age, the guys I were fighting were bigger men.
Yeah.
You know, I heard a great line. Somebody asked Clark Gillies about me, and he goes, Oh, I was shocked at how strong he was, the strength that he possessed. I didn't expect that. And I put a lot of work into that, John, to try to. But, you know, even my brother said, he goes, you know, I had this picture of you squaring off with Ben Wilson. And he goes, you had no fear. And I'm like, I couldn't. I didn't let that creep in. I was having so much fun trying to be a player, trying to keep my head above water in the league, right? And so the big guys to go out against them, I mean, there's the potential of really getting hit and getting hit hard. Because Ben Wilson scared a lot of people. Ben Wilson and Junior got suspended in the Ontario Hockey League for the rest of the season, and Philadelphia Flyers called him up and played him the rest of the year. Right? Seriously. Ben scared our guys. And, you know, I squared off with him in Chicago, and he probably doesn't remember it. I think by the end of it, he picked me up and dumped me on my head, right? But Clark Gillies and Willie Plett, he nailed me once really hard, right in the mush. You're 20 years of age, but you don't take a step backwards. You just keep taking that step forward and bringing it on, right? But then you learned, I need to be the guy. I need to be the guy because I'm with Wayne Gretzky. I need, when I say something, it needs to mean something.
Yeah.
So I didn't yell a lot of idle threats. Like, I would go over to a bench and say, Joe, if that fourth line guy doesn't come out and fight me, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to hurt you bad. And the coach swearing at me, I said, no, I mean it. You send that fourth guy out to fight me because he's not going to come out and spear our guys and hurt our guys. You got to mean what you say and be willing at the time to take a 4 or 5 game suspension, not to go and just do something randomly, but to do it with thought through reasoning as to why it's there. I grabbed Joe Sakic one night. He was going off the ice. I said, Joe. And I said, no. What are you going off? Because I'm playing against you all night, Joe. So you need to stay on the ice because I get to play more.
Was it who?
But the little guys, John, the little guys frustrated me because I had a long reach. And if you get the little guys, once you get them, like Wendell was good. He'd get in tight. And he was good with both hands. He could punch. He was tough as nails. He would be more than willing to take a punch. But once I got him out, now the linesmen break it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted my time then, right? And I got to the point where I was taking my jersey off because I had guys that would try to tangle up the jersey.
Yep.
I had one guy, and I'm not going to embarrass him by saying who. I dropped both my arms, and I said, come on, take a punch. I dare you. And he was like, stop, you know, cussing at me because he just wanted the 5 minutes, but he didn't want to fight.
Just to say, right? I fought Marty McSorley. Yeah,
and I just dropped my hands and I said, come on, throw a punch, I dare you. So I had tried to get where my jersey came off, and I think what that did is that separated the really big guys who could fight and wanted to fight to the guys that did the job, but it wasn't really who they were.
Yeah.
Right? And you know those guys.
When did you start sewing your caps, your shoulder pads to your suspenders?
To my suspenders?
Yeah.
I did that in Edmonton because I didn't have – I just put the caps on.
Like, when did that start? Because that's not normal.
Edmonton. Because I wore nothing. I wore nothing on my chest and nothing on my stomach. And even my pants, I cut a bunch of the padding out. So if I took my jersey off, I only had the caps. And what I would do, John, is I'd cut the seam in my undershirt here. Yeah. And I'd cut the seam here so that if somebody grabbed the undershirt, I wouldn't get the burn from the shirt. It would actually tear away.
You're greasy.
So then they had nothing. They had to fight, right?
So. You're greasy. And who were like, because Wayne, obviously you play the Oilers. I know you were deep, but it's like, let's get Wayne off his game. Was there one or two guys who like were good at it that you couldn't get to?
Well, it's later in his career, Wayne would say, oh, you got to get this guy off me. Chelly was probably the best.
Oh, is that right?
Because what Chelly would do, Chelly was smart, right? And Chelly could skate. Chelly would get up ice and angle Wayne early and make Wayne move the puck really early. And so Wayne was used to people backing up and giving him space, and he'd pick them apart. He'd get them across their feet the wrong way or whatever. Yeah. You know how he'd come in the blue line and fake hold in up, and then spin around and hit late guys or whatever. What Chelly would do is, like, just as Wayne was get over the blue line, Chelly would come in on a hard angle and get Wayne to move the puck. And it drove Wayne crazy. but he didn't hit him. He just he just contained
in his pocket. Yeah,
right. And so, I mean, what do I do? Do I go up and go, Chili? You got to stay away from Wayne.
Stop skating next to Wayne.
Right, right. I almost said to Wayne, you almost got to, Wayne, you got to skate faster.
You had 10 years with him. Was there ever a time like where you just go, how is this my life? Because you're a kid from, what town were you from? Because I'm from St. Catharines. And if you're 50 miles south of Hamilton. Okay.
Cayuga,
so you're
the old Speedway drag strip work.
Oh yeah. I've been there many times. So you're from a kid from Cayuga and you look over like, holy crap. Like I'm on the best team to ever lace them up. And did you ever just, I'm sure you do it now many times, but while you're in the moment, that's got to be something cool, Marty.
Oh, you know, John, listen, I'm, as you know, I'm a big fan of the game.
Yep.
I mean, when like we had the outdoor game at Edmonton, I remember the day before there was like 15,000 school kids. They bust in at 15 below zero. I had to take my toque off because just the hair in the back of my neck stood up. And I'm like, here we were playing the greats, the Larry Robinsons, the Guy Lafleurs and all those guys from Montreal. And I've got Gretzky and Messier and Coffey and Grant Fuhr and all these wonderful players. And trust me, I there's every day people will talk about hockey. And I know how fortunate I was to be put into that environment and try to make the best I could of it. So absolutely. And, you know, Wayne was gracious with his time. Like he would say, hey, you want to go here? And he'd say, hey, Marty, get three of the young guys and bring them up and I'll take them golfing today or whatever. So I'd drive them up and we'd play golf and it would give him a chance to get familiar with those young guys. And, you know, in the locker room, because Wayne has so much going on, he's getting pulled. I would try to tease him and have fun with him and get him laughing. And you know, and there's times he and I had some serious, you know, arguments.
Yeah.
Because I think I could say things to him that maybe other guys wouldn't. I even had a coach once. I come off and I'm like, that is garbage. What, you know, what they were doing. He goes, well, we'll tell him.
Can you tell Wayne this for me?
Right. Look at the coach like, right. So, but because Wayne was a fan himself and Wayne got it, he really did. So he and I could have those. But it comes from a really good place. And it's just a ton of respect. I saw Wayne grow the game. I saw how much pull there was on him. People would say, oh, wouldn't you love Wayne Gretzky's life? I said, boy, you'd have to be prepared to do all the things that he's called upon, right? And in his life and over the course of his hockey career, the demands on him were unbelievable.
Oh, probably incredible. So speaking of growing the game, is it true that you tried to buy a team, you and your brother over in England, the Cardiff Blue Devils or something like that? It didn't really work out or what? What's behind this rumor, Marty?
Well, you know, John, I went over there. It was the lockout in 94 and I was helping negotiate that. And my brother was the coach of the Great Britain national team. Philip Anschutz, who owns the Kings and actually owns part of the Lakers and owns the crypto.com building and a number of buildings. I think he owns, what, 8 different buildings around Europe. He's a really, really smart man. He's a nice man too, really. Well, Chris went over to London, England before the O2 was built. They bought the Anschutz Entertainment Group, bought the team, and Chris coached for them for a couple of years so that they could try to have a foothold and build themselves a big 20,000 seat stadium. The hockey team didn't give them enough footing, but they went ahead and built the O2, which has been massively successful. You know, but then they went ahead and they bought the Globen in Stockholm. They built the rink in Berlin. They built the rink in Prague. They built the rink in Munich, and they own all those teams. They've been massive. And then now they you know, the concerts and ice capades and all the rest, they'll book 25, 30 events in all their buildings and send them over, right? So brilliant man, great. Chris went over, coached the two years in London, England, and he was then given the coach of the Great Britain national team. Guys like Tony Hand, who tried out with the Edmonton Oilers, and there were some good players over there. I went over to play in a charity game over there. And when I got over there, my brother wheeling and dealing, I'm then asked about my ownership share on the potential, and I'm like, really? I look at my brother and he kind of shrugs his shoulders. And so, I mean, when I got over there, John, it was news to me.
That's so funny.
But it didn't surprise me because it was my brother kind of just testing the waters to see what it would take to get the team, checking out the finances of it. He then went to Geneva and was owner, coach, and GM there long time and was tremendously successful.
Yeah. Wow.
So, but Cardiff is beautiful, and I enjoyed my time over there, and I knew a few guys from training camps in the NHL and some guys that from junior who had come over to the OHL to try out and went back there and played for a long time. The hockey world's a great world, and you see guys surface at different times, and it's good to see them and see them have success in wherever they're at, you know.
It's such a good world, and a world where I get to hang out with you sometimes is the world I like being in. But yeah, I don't want to keep you anymore, Marty. I could sit here and talk. You've been a part of such like huge moments in the NHL, obviously the Gretzky trade, the illegal curve on the stick, which was BS. I don't want to go on that. So,
you know, getting rid of Allan Eagleson and elevating the game to such a huge amount, you know, I mean, to me, that is something that I'm extremely proud of too, you know, and then the first lockout, you know, being really involved with the players and giving a lot of those guys an opportunity to kind of to be free agents, to go and make very good livings and get a good pension and all of those things, John. I'm really proud of those moments too, you know.
Well, you built it's so funny, everyone's like, oh, the CBA and you guys are doing great. It's like we're standing on the work that you guys did back in the day. Because I was a part of the negotiation stuff too. And I can't imagine, because ours was very minuscule. It's like, oh, the escrow, oh, you know, this and that. Those are little things compared to what you guys were fighting for, to what we got these days.
Yeah, it was at that time, it was, they wanted a salary cap and we were like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And so it was just a whole philosophy of where the direction the game is going to go in. And it was tense. I mean, my owner was told unequivocally to put me on the street, not to trade me, put him on the street.
Gone.
Yes.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Just because you were so good at negotiating, or you had the
players I don't think I was the only person. I know. I'm not going to take that credit. I think that I was standing my ground and really being vocal and communicating as much as I can to so many of the guys, but I was not alone. No. I won't take that. I wasn't alone. I was surrounded by, you know, Kenny Baumgartner, Kelly Miller. There was a number of really good people that stood up, you know, the Dean Kennedys, all those guys Brad McCrimmon even, right? Brad McCrimmon said, if I lose my last year's pay, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Just as long as you guys don't cave in and give in. He said, if this is what you want, he goes, I'm with it 100%. It's probably my last year. I mean,
that's unbelievable.
What a great thing, huh?
Yeah. How do you feel like the game is now? You know, that they obviously just signed a new CBA for 4 more years, supposedly growing the TV deals and everything. Do you think the game's in a good spot?
Yeah, I would like to see some rule changes a little bit.
Like what?
I think you could continue to open it up. What if you only allowed 4 guys back on your own end?
Okay, that's crazy. One guy stands out in the neutral zone?
Well, you don't then you want to push the game. You want to be on the offensive side. You're not just going to come back and play 1-0 hockey, right? You're going to have to get up ice and push the point. And, you know, we can't make the rinks any bigger. These guys are monsters, right?
Yeah. I mean,
and you give your skilled players more ice to work with. So if
I'm
you
just
have
trying
a guy
to wrap my head around it.
If you put a guy out in the neutral zone, do you put a defender out there with him?
That's what I was just thinking. Do you have someone back?
Do you or don't you? But you have to play offense. Because they want more offense in the game. Do the goalies then handle the puck more?
Yeah. I had a coach. You know Kevin Constantine?
Yeah.
So he would do that with us, where if we were down a goal, he would send a forward and sit him out by the far blue line. And it forces the other team to make a decision. So it does confuse things. That's it, Marty. That's a wild idea.
Yeah. And see, I don't like the trapezoids. I hate the trapezoids.
Yeah.
Because I think When they got rid of the red line, the purpose there was that you can make the pass, right? You can then have, because I was hoping it would really help the rush of the game. You know, I love to see the speed, the north-south, race the puck to the net.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you got guys at the far blue line just deflect the puck in the zone.
Yeah, so you want the goalies to be able to play it and get the puck moving.
Right, but if you do that, I don't think you're just going to deflect it into the zone.
Yeah, you're going to skate it in.
You're going to have to skate it in. you know, you're going to have to come back and get speed up and, uh-huh. and, you know, and go on the rush, which I think the rush, I think every 3-on-2 and a 2-on-1 is a mini power play.
How have you not been approached by the league or a team? Because you're obviously a bright guy. Or have you been? You just said no thanks.
No. Well, I left. I was with Phoenix for a couple of years. Enjoyed it. Really, really big money woes there at the time.
Yeah.
Really big money woes. And, you know, I was told if an East Coast League player, if he's on my roster as a fill-in, get him off the ice and in his car before midnight.
Oh, so they can send him down?
So they don't have to pay him for half the next day on his East Coast League salary.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it was that's where I had for 2 years. But, you know, John, I that was a really controlling scenario. Mm-hmm. This guy plays 25 minutes. This guy plays 23 minutes. This guy plays this guy are your first power play. To me, that I wasn't coaching. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that's fine. And my wife and I, we started a family. And I'm going to be brutally honest. We were bumping our heads a little bit on keeping pregnancies and whatever. I went through a lot, as a lot of families do. So it's been great. I've got an 18, 16, and a 14-year-old. My oldest daughter starts at Arizona State this year. She's going to play beach volleyball there. And I'm thrilled. The great thing, too, is my nephew now with the NIL, he's came down from the Erie Otters. He's going to ASU. They have a wonderful hockey team there. Yeah. So, you know, I'm gonna get a lot of that. So that'll be fun for me, John. John, I might in a few years.
Okay.
Investigate about getting a junior team.
Ah.
And for me, I think you have to build good young men first. Yep. When you build good young men and then teach them how to play with a love of the game, that to me would be fun. I would enjoy that.
In Cayuga, you'd go home.
No. I would think it would be more of a Canadian Hockey League team.
Okay. Right. Gosh, Marty, that'd be fantastic.
That'd be fun.
You're still a young guy. You still look at you. You still look like a moose. You're built like a brick, you know what house.
Come on, my 16-year-old son can outdrive me, John.
Wow.
And you saw me on the ice in Halifax.
That's you were limping a little bit. You had a little fall in the hotel room before that. You weren't looking too hot, but you look good now.
I went in and had both my hips replaced again. Oh. What I didn't know is the implants were dead loose. They were moving.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So that's when I fell. It's, you know, I would pick up my leg and when you go to turn your foot and it wouldn't turn. Things like that that I didn't know until you further investigate. So much, much better than that time.
And your son, I saw him setting up the computer for you because you're just illiterate technologically wise. He's jacked. The kid's got like he's doing okay. He can outdrive me too, probably. But anyways, Mark, I don't want to keep you. Like, this was such a treat for me. I loved it. Thank you so much. I hopefully will come across your path again one day and we can, you know, have another.
John, I'd love to. It's always great to catch up, pal. And, you know, I love to watch you guys out there. The young guys, you know, I was always cheering for the guys, the tough guys. And, you know, when a tough guy would score, I would be like, oh, that is so awesome.
I didn't do that much. So not as much as you did. But, yeah, I should have spent a little more time working on my game, Marty, like you did.
Yeah, but the success. Get the tough guys go and have success, right?
I do. I got 8 kids now, Marty. So I'm chasing the girls around.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did you figure it out?
No, I still don't know. So I've been running after all girls too. So I just spend all my time running after them and just it's good. I'm not complaining.
Good for you, pal. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Marty McSorley, everybody. Thanks for joining us, Marty. And we'll talk to you next time. Cheers.
Thanks, John.
Oh.
Hi, it's GK Barry from Saving Grace, and I'm sponsored by Funkin' Cocktails, bar quality cocktails straight from the can. You literally crack open the can and it hisses at you with this lush sound because it's infused with nitrogen, making them super smooth like a bartender's just shaking it up for you. So if you want to impress your friends, give them round for a girls' night, serve them one of these and just say you made it. And you know I'm a passion fruit girly, well these are made with real fruit and taste bang on. No wonder they're the UK's number one cocktail brand. Head to your nearest store or visit funkincocktails.co.uk to grab a cocktail today, and as always, please drink responsibly.
There's always a lot going on. I'm on site getting the job done, running the business too, payments, invoices, admin, all on me. But now with Tap to Pay, I can take payments there and then, and Sage sorts the admin afterwards. Everything's sorted in the background, so I don't spend hours doing it later. Magic.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping British businesses like Mike at Residual Electrical Contractors. That's more than artificial intelligence, that's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. T's and C's apply.